This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, the market seems to be euphoric. It is anticipating major stimulus spending coming from the government, tax cuts, and all kinds of other things that will help the economy grow at a faster rate. But could there be problems in implementation? Joining me on the program is A. Gary Schilling. He's editor of A. Gary Schilling's Insight. He's also author of The Age of Deleveraging. Gary, I want to begin our discussion with trade because the president can do a number of things. He can propose, but Congress legislates, and that's certainly what's going to happen, whether it's repealing Obamacare, cutting taxes, or fiscal spending. But let's begin with trade. In your recent Insight, you talk about China. When we look at China, we see that China is moving on a number of fronts. Economically, in their Silk Road project, they are building ports, railroads, dams, pipelines, and industrial corridors across a swath of countries in Asia, Europe, and Africa that is going to expand its economic role. They're also building military bases. But let's begin with China, because the president claims that they've been involved in trade war and unfairly treating us when it comes to trade. I'd like to get your thoughts on that and some of the issues that are at front here.
Well, to begin with, all this money that China has to spend on the Silk Road and all the other things you mentioned, Jim, you can say that's courtesy of U.S. consumers, because it's really U.S. consumers importing cheap Chinese goods, and no reason they shouldn't. They're much less expensive than buying them domestically made, but that poured tremendous amounts of money into China. China has had a consistent huge trade surplus. That means that they end up owning a lot of U.S. assets, because when they're exporting more than they're importing, they end up at the end of the day with a difference, which adds to their reserves. And their foreign currency reserves were $4 trillion. They've now had to reduce them to accommodate the rush of money trying to get out of China. They're down to actually a little less than $3 trillion. But still, that's a lot of money, and it gives them a tremendous amount of the wherewithal to go out and spend it on anything they want to, buy assets in the U.S. or invest in Asia or whatever. So I'm not blaming the Chinese. I'm just saying, if you want to say, where did they get the dough? It was basically from U.S. and European consumers as well. But they're the ones that were buying all these products and piling up these assets in the hands of China. Now China is obviously very interested in moving out internationally. You know, it's interesting, in Shakespeare's, I think it's Henry V, they're having a war with France, and the dying King Henry advises his son, Prince Hal. He says, busy, giddy minds with foreign quarrels. In other words, if you got problems at home, go out and start some war or something overseas. And I think that's got something to do with China. Their economic growth is slowing. They no longer have the huge export growth. That's what got them there, but with slow growth in Europe and Japan, we're just not buying as much at a rapid rate of growth as we did earlier from China and other developing countries. So their exports are actually declining. They used to be growing 20-30%. That game is over. They also, as this slowed, they invested in a lot of infrastructure, and that ended up with ghost cities, excess capacity, and huge debts. So China's growth is definitely slowing, and I think that President Xi, who's running the place and increasingly with an iron hand, is trying to divert attention away from the domestic scene. It's not only these foreign adventures, and of course, on top of that, China thinks they're the world's top culture, and they were, you go back, 1,000 years or so before anybody had ever in the West had heard of China, much more developed than they were in the West. But with the Industrial Revolution, which they really refused because they thought they had the best of all possible worlds, they lost out, and in the 19th century, they were dominated by the Europeans. They still are smarting over that. So they're really kind of reassorting their authority. So that's another reason that they're out on these adventures. But it's interesting, just going back to what they're doing, Xi is instituting a really top-down, call it a spy network. It's George Orwell's 1984 Big Brother. Now they have legions of inspectors that are checking into even low-level party members on a regional basis to make sure that they have correct thinking and so on. And obviously, this is what I've dubbed the current Mao dynasty. This Mao dynasty, they read their history, and they know that a lot of previous Chinese dynasties got tossed out because of labor unrest, usually because of high unemployment. And so these guys, I think, they're trying to divert attention with this grand international exposure, attention from a slowing domestic economy. They're trying to tighten up their grip domestically. I think it's all part of a grand scheme and really quite understandable and even predictable.
Well, it was amazing because at Davos, President Xi was coming across as a free trader. But Gary, as you allude to in your article, whether it comes from dumping excess steel, aluminum, and other products, stealing Western technology, transfers, limitations on Facebook in terms of China, and also recently a lot of companies have said that China is kind of clamping down on other companies that are operating in the States. So does Trump have actually his facts when he talks about they are engaged in a trade war in many senses?
Oh, yeah. I think we're already in a trade war. Now, of course, in any war, it's the other side that always are the bad guys and we're the good guys, let's face it. And we have our own biases. And there's no question we have a lot of anti-dumping laws and regulations. We have something called the International Trade Commission, which is a U.S. body, but industries can bring charges of anti-dumping against foreigners and steel, for example, and they can get judgments by the U.S. government. They have to be endorsed by the president ultimately, but you know we're not completely immune from this game. But I think any reasonable person looking at it objectively would say that China has been running very much a mercantilist policy, and that's part of this whole desire to build up their assets to export, to limit imports, to demand technological transfer of anybody who wants to be in China, to refuse to let our companies into attractive areas there, to reserve them for their national champions or state-owned enterprises. And, of course, it was really almost laughable, as you mentioned, with Xi at Davos. He says he's a big globalist and Trump is a protectionist, kind of an attempt to sketch a reversal roles when it's really been quite the opposite. But I think here's a very important point, Jim, and one I keep constantly making. I made it in that article in our monthly newsletter, Insight, and many, many times elsewhere. But when you're in a situation where you have global surpluses of almost everything, and there's plenty of labor, there's plenty of productive capacity around the world to meet demand today, when you have a situation, who's got the upper hand? It's the buyer. It's not the seller. It's the buyer, and we're the buyer. And China and other developing countries are the sellers. And I think Trump instinctively understands that, as do the Chinese leaders. So they're very much on the defensive here. And this idea we're big globalists and we've got to solve this all together and so on and so forth. I mean, that's almost laughable, but what do you expect? I mean, I wouldn't say they're completely cornered, but they're certainly being pushed that way.
Let's talk about some of the internal conflicts that are going on in China itself. As you pointed out, Gary, their exports have dropped as a percentage of the economy, and they're trying to make this transition from an investment-driven economy to a consumer-driven economy. But if you take a look at offsetting a lot of what has happened as a drop in exports, they've used infrastructure spending, which has created huge excess capacity. As you talked about, there's plenty of labor and capacity, which has given rise to ghost cities and a gigantic debt burden, which has gone from 164% to well over 200% of GDP. And there's this hope that consumer spending will pick up, or let's say carry the torch, from all this infrastructure spending. But China's consumer spending, as you point out in your newsletter, accounted for only 37% of GDP in 2015, and that's the lowest of any G7 country.
Yeah, that's correct. And G7 or BRICS, if you throw in India, Brazil, Russia, you know, I think the lowest is 55%, and you know, China's almost off the map. They have very much emphasized production and building up the government. And again, it's a top-down kind of society, so they can do that. They obviously realize they have to make a transition, but it's a difficult one. First of all, they're starting at a very low level. Secondly, they have, institutionally, they have a lot of restraints on this. They're geared up for production, not for consumption in that country. It isn't like this country where, you know, basically it's what consumers spend only runs the economy. And if it's electronic gadgets, fine, or health food or junk food or whatever, it's primarily consumer, but it's very different in China. Another interesting point is that China is a Confucian society. And in that society, it's very important, part of the Confucian tenets is that people take care of their families. They provide for their families, and that means they tend to be big savers. They have low incomes, and they save an extraordinarily high amount of that. I mean, we save about 5% of our consumers' after-tax income. In China, it's more like 20 or 25%. And they're saving that to provide for their families and so on. And another thing, they don't have the equivalent of Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid in China, or student loans. So people have to save for their kids' education. They have to save for their retirement, for their health care, and so on and so forth. And that also encourages high saving and holds down consumer spending. Now, the Chinese are trying to change that. I think a few years ago, there was a feeling it was going to happen in a couple of years. But it's really probably a decade-long project at minimum.
I want to talk about some of the issues on Chinese growth and also the possibility of a hard landing. They're using figures of economic growth of 6.7%, which is a far cry from the 12, 13, 14% of the last decade. But Gary, as you point out and others, nobody believes those numbers. They're probably about half of that. So they have all these see-through cities where you have all these buildings where they call them ghost cities. How can they prevent an economic bubble from bursting when they're still, you know, they're trying to clamp down on credit extended to the real estate sector? But how do you prevent a bubble from collapsing?
They just basically legislate that it can't collapse. They pump money into failing institutions. I mean, most of the state-owned enterprises, which control most of the Japanese production, are in effect subsidized by the government one way or the other, and they just keep pumping money into them because they're very inefficient, but they employ over half the workforce, so they just keep supporting them one way or the other. It's not unlike, Jim, Japan. You and I can remember the zombie companies in Japan after their real estate and stock collapses in the early 90s. Japan, they didn't have anything like we did where we cleaned up the banks and bailed them out and so on. They kept them on, and they just kept pumping in them. They called them zombie banks because they literally were dead, but nobody admitted it, and everybody just agreed that they weren't. It's the same thing. They just pretend, delay and pray on bad loans. They, in effect, said that they are good. And when you don't have a market economy that forces these things, when you don't have the ability of somebody to go to court and force somebody into bankruptcy and so on, there's no way that these things naturally play out. So, yeah, I think China, if China were a open economy, they probably would be in deep, deep trouble right now. But it's really a very controlled economy. And as long as they have that control, I think they probably can keep it going much further than anybody would expect.
Well, let's talk about Xi's plan, which is ultimately to devalue the currency. Now, China switches back and forth in terms of what they link their currency, whether it's to the dollar or a trade-weighted basket, whatever suits their needs. Trump said he would brand them as a currency manipulator, which appears that they're doing that. What are the chances that China does devalue the currency, number one? And number two, what do you think the U.S. response would be?
Well, they are devaluing the currency. I mean, if you go back 2 years ago, they had a big nosedive in their stocks. They bailed them out, but did it very clumsily. And I think since then, the currency, the yuan against the dollar, is down about 7%, which is a lot for a major currency. And they want to devalue it. And as you mentioned, they shift back and forth between tying their currency to the dollar and tying it to a basket of about 20 other currencies. So they can switch it almost on a daily basis to hide the fact that they really are devaluing. In other words, if the dollar goes up, they say, well, we're tied to the basket. We're just floating down with the basket. They switch back and forth. But they do want to devalue. Now, what prevents them from just cutting it loose and letting the thing collapse are two factors. One is the likes of Senator Chuck Schumer, the minority leader, Democratic minority leader in the Senate, who is very much against China, as well as Trump is, on currency manipulation. And in other words, they don't want to make any more waves than necessary. And the other one is this outflow of money. Because when somebody wants to take money out of China, now they make it very difficult, but money still has a way of seeping out. And what happens? Somebody's got a pile of yuan, their currency, that he wants to take out. Well, he wants dollars. How is he going to get the dollars? Well, he basically has to trade yuan for dollars. Where do those dollars come from? They come from that pile of foreign currency reserves. In other words, the central bank basically buys in its own currency and gives the guys dollars when they want to leave. And they have suffered net currency outflows for the last, oh, I think it's 3 years, almost every month by month. And that's what's run their foreign currency reserves, I mentioned earlier, from $4 trillion down to, as of December, latest data, a little less than $3 trillion. So they can accommodate this, but it is expensive. And, of course, the question is, how long will they let it go? If you just put a ruler on that trend, it would take about 8.5 years for them to run out of foreign currency reserves. And I don't think anybody expects them to go to that length. But they obviously are doing that, and they I think there's no question they're trying to devalue their currency because they want to have a cheaper currency to make their exports more attractive, cheaper to foreigners, and their imports more expensive, and therefore more production and less imports. You know, that's a classic protectionist move. When you have a weak domestic economy, you unload the problem on foreigners. You can do it with, again, a lot of these other restrictions on foreign investment and demanding technological transfer, and there's always health and safety regulations. They'll fit if nothing else does, but currency devaluation is pretty much the standard. And China isn't alone. The whole world is really trying to devalue against the dollar, and we're the only currency that can't devalue because, you know, we're it. We're the world's currency. There's nobody we can devalue against.
So as you look at China, given its overinflated economy, you have real estate prices, they're trying to control it. And as you pointed out, they can just kind of legislate, hey, we're not going to have a crash. Are you more in the muddle through? Because there's different views if you look at China today. One is a hard landing. Hey, they have a real estate bubble. They have a bubble with excess capacity. They have an aging population. There are a lot of people who are saying that sooner or later, they're going to have a hard landing. Others are saying they can muddle through. Which camp do you fall in?
That's a very good question. I would rephrase it, Jim, because you have to differentiate between China domestically and China on the international scene. I think domestically, China can have a very hard landing. I mentioned 2 years ago, they had about a 20% overnight decline in stock prices. They had been pushing them up. They wanted to encourage stocks as a way of financing to get rid of all the debt buildup. In other words, they want a debt refinanced in stocks, as they're worried, as you mentioned earlier, about huge debt increases. They bungled the job. They had to order banks and brokers to support the market. They banned analysts writing any negative reports. I think some of those guys literally went to jail who tried it. But that was internal, and we knew about it. You know, there's enough they can't bottle up all the news. We knew about it. But the effects on the rest of the world were limited. So I would take that as an analogy and say that China could have a considerable problems internally, but it is not necessarily going to shake the whole world stage because China is relatively isolated. It's a controlled economy. It's not a free market. And a matter of fact, at the beginning of last year, I wrote a special report for our monthly newsletter Insight called Chinese Sunset. And I was pointing out that just like Japan in the 80s, everybody thought Japan was going to take over the world. I remember I'd go to suburban cocktail parties and matrons would come up to me very worried and they'd say, hey, Gary, isn't my husband going to be working for a Japanese company or run out of business by what? And that's one of the reasons that I came to the conclusion that Japan was just about at the top. And it was at the end of the 1980s. And, you know, Japan's the third largest economy now. But what do you hear about Japan today? I mean, not much. I mean, Abe, their prime minister, comes over here. He makes nice with Trump. Okay, wonderful. But you don't hear that much about Japan. Nothing like the 80s. I think China is now in the same way. They're the second largest economy. But they're large because they got a lot of people. Their income per capita is only 14% of that of the U.S. It's just because they got 1.3 billion people that matter versus our having 350 million. And I think that as this growth by export game is over and just about all the manufacturing that could be shifted out of North America and Europe to China and other developing countries has been, that game is pretty much over. So I think that China on the global stage doesn't have nearly the importance that it had earlier. So they could have big problems internally. We'd all be fascinated by it. But in terms of really shaking up the world, I'm not sure it would be kind of cataclysmic by a long shot.
I want to talk about what we're seeing going on in trade and especially with the Trump administration. And I don't know if the president really understands this, but the dollar being the world's reserve currency, Gary, most trade conducted in the world today is conducted in dollars. If Trump is successful, let's say he shrinks the U.S. trade deficit, which means there's less dollars out there to work with. I mean, you talk about China's currency reserves, a good portion of that is held in dollars. If we shrink our trade deficit, which means there's less dollars being exported to the rest of the world. What does this do to the dollar, and what could this do to emerging markets?
Well, it no doubt is beneficial for the dollar because, among other things, whenever there's chaos in the world, the dollar is the ultimate reserve currency and safe haven benefits. But it is an interesting phenomenon. This was first identified many decades ago by a Belgian-American economist, Robert Triffin. Triffin was at Yale, and he came up with what was called the Triffin paradox. It was simply this: the world needs liquidity. And in other words, to grow, you need more and more liquid assets out there, which means that some country has to be providing those. Now, the way they get provided is by a country running a trade deficit, or more broadly, what's called a current account deficit. It's the same as trade deficit with a few more bells and whistles. But it means that is the amount of money that is pumped out of the U.S. each year going into foreign hands. And if you do not have that in size, the rest of the world simply doesn't have enough liquidity to operate. In other words, you need liquidity to buy and sell and for asset transfers and for reserves and so on and so forth. So, ironically, if we dramatically reduce our trade and current account deficits, the rest of the world would be in deep difficulty because you simply would not have that liquidity out there. Now, you know, that wouldn't help anybody, but I think we'd end up as a valedictorian in summer remedial school. It wouldn't be so hot for the U.S., but we would clearly be on top because, again, in times of trouble, there's a rush for the dollar. And we are relatively low exposed to foreign trade. Our exports are 13% of GDP. We're largely a domestic economy. If you look at Canada, it's 30%. Germany, it's 50%. A lot of us in the financial area are keenly aware of the rest of the world, but if you look at most businesses in this country, they are domestically oriented, and we're such a large economy that we just don't have that foreign exposure. So for all those reasons, I think the U.S. would end up on top, but it certainly wouldn't be an attractive situation, certainly for the rest of the world.
Yeah, because I've always maintained the U.S. has the best-looking house in a global neighborhood because there are a couple things. Number one, we have the world's largest economy. Number two, we're more self-reliant than other countries. And three, we have the world's reserve currency. And, as you mentioned, when it comes to trade, we are the largest buyer, or let's say the buyer of last resort. So does that not give the president a lot of leverage?
Oh, it certainly does. And again, I keep coming back to the idea, not only the size, the fact that we're the market that everybody wants to be in, but in trade negotiations, we're the buyer, they're the seller. We got the advantage. I mean, you look at Mexico, for example, and it's really China and Mexico, which have been the focus of this trade discussion lately. I mean, Mexico really advertised itself as the way that European and Asian producers, autos and others, could get into the U.S. duty-free. In other words, they basically said, produce your cars in Mexico. We have low cost here. We've got an efficient, up-to-date plants and so on. You can build them here, and then you can export under NAFTA duty-free to the U.S. They went out and sold themselves on that basis. Well, of course, that wasn't the original intent of NAFTA. NAFTA was the idea was going to be trading among the three North American countries, U.S., Canada, and Mexico, and it wasn't going to be an entree vis-a-vis Mexico to the U.S. So there's concern there, but regardless of how you come down on that issue, the facts are that Mexico has tremendous, 80% of their exports go to the U.S. They have a tremendous dependence on the U.S., and anything there that shakes up the relationship is tough for Mexico. I mean, the current president of Mexico, he probably won't survive. He turned down this invitation to go to Washington after Trump made some, his usual comments about building a wall and making the Mexicans pay for it. But Mexico could end up in the hands of the next possible president there is very much on the left. I mean, Mexico could end up in much worse shape on this whole thing, and it wouldn't do anybody any good, Mexico or the U.S. But the point is that Mexico has very little power in this whole situation, and of course, with their national pride at stake, it makes it much difficult. I would just throw this in. China, I think, China is very different. When you've got a top-down economy, you know, you do what you're told, you end up in jail or dead. It's a lot easier to control, as long as there isn't a popular revolution, of course. But in China, I think the Chinese are very pragmatic, and they're probably going to give way an awful lot on the thing of intellectual property and letting us into industries and so on. But Mexico, I think it's more than a showdown at the OK Corral. It's their national identity. It's their pride at stake.
I want to move on as we leave China in trade, because there seems to be, if there's anything the president can do without having to go through Congress, trade would be one of them. I want to move on to a couple other things that the president is working on and things he ran on during his campaign. One is lowering corporate and individual income taxes. The other one is fiscal spending on defense and infrastructure. Let's begin with that, because the markets are moving, Gary, in anticipation. Even though this is an aging business cycle and the Fed is raising interest rates, that this fiscal spending, whether it comes from tax cuts or infrastructure spending, is going to take place. We have had fiscal austerity the last number of years under Obama. You write, fiscal austerity is dead. And that seemed to go out with the budget bill in November of 2015, where they busted everything and the deficit went up for 2016. And a lot of that is based on voter frustration. They haven't seen job growth. Some of the jobs, a lot of people have been downsized. But Gary, you and I know that Washington is a sausage factory. The president can propose, but it's Congress that is going to actually depose. So if he is wanting to spend money, and there seems to be agreement between both parties to do that, Gary, you know, the way government works, it takes time for infrastructure to get, well, let's say authorized, number one, and number two, implemented and actually spent. As President Obama had to admit, there, I guess there wasn't that many shovel-ready projects. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal this week that talked about the issues of environmentalism that are slowing down projects. We have two cities in California that have been litigating over a 6-mile stretch of highway for 60 years. Bridges sometimes take 15 years to go through approval, environmental impact studies to get approved. So what is the chance of, let's say, this year we do get some kind of fiscal spending bill that's passed by both parties, signed by the president, before its impact into the economy? Could it not be 2 or 3 years at the earliest before any of this gets implemented?
Very much so. This is a point that we made. You know, you had this initial burst of enthusiasm right after the election that we were going to have instant huge fiscal stimuli and rapid growth, and that was going to flood the market with treasuries to finance it. Interest rates shot up, et cetera, et cetera. And the position we took in our monthly newsletter Insight at that point was that people were really jumping the gun. And it's very much as you describe it, Jim. You go back to 2009 when they, part of that fiscal stimulus bill with these so-called shovel-ready projects. Well, it turned out they hadn't even made the shovels yet, and they probably were going to be made in China anyway. And 2 years later, 2 years after that bill was enacted by Congress, only 30% of that money had been spent. Now, why is that? Money is allocated, particularly for infrastructure, by the federal government, but it's spent by the states. And there you get into the kinds of things you're talking about, the environmental impact statements, and particularly a state like California, where there's tremendous resistance to any kind of development. And then all the zoning laws and the contracts have to be designed. It turned out that a lot of the people at the local level that were going to design those contracts, they didn't even exist. They had to be hired and trained. And say it takes a long time. And so it's probably 2 or 3 years. Now, that's after it gets through Congress. But bear in mind that Congress is largely a domestically oriented institution. Yeah, Congress can declare war in the international area, but the international areas where the president has pretty much unilateral authority. Look what Obama did on the immigration issue with executive orders and what Trump is doing to reverse them. Tremendous power internationally. But when it comes to infrastructure spending, that's where Congress gets into the act, because that's domestic. And Trump, not everybody in Congress is his bosom buddy, let's put it euphemistically. And he's finding that out now with he can't even get all these cabinet picks approved. So this is going to be a drawn-out process, and I think it's ultimately going to be very big. My hunch is that it's because voters are mad as hell. You've had no growth in inflation-adjusted income in the U.S. or any other G7 country for over a decade. And, you know, this is the words of that Howard Beale in that old movie Network, when the guy was a fired TV anchor and he gets out of his chair, runs to the window, throws it up and says, "I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore." Well, that's the way voters are. And so they rejected mainstream politicians. They turned to the fringes, whether it's Marie Le Pen in France or Bernie Sanders here or certainly Trump. And politicians of all stripes realize realize this. Even before the election, it was pretty clear in Congress that there was a widespread interest in infrastructure spending. And of course, the Republicans in control now, they also favor defense spending, and they point to China building these islands in the South China Sea for military purposes, and Putin trying to resurrect the Russian Empire, and Japan coming out from under its post-World War II neutrality. So I think we're going to get a lot of stimulus, and I've suggested that just the infrastructure part of it, and this is roads, bridges, electric grids, railroads, what have you, I've suggested that could be as big as the interstate highway program of the 50s and 60s, and that pushed up economic growth by, when you work it through the system, about 1 percentage point. So it could be very substantial when you're talking about economy, which so far in this expansion has been growing only 2.1%. Hey, 1% on top of that is a lot in terms of added growth. I think this is going to happen, but it'll take time. But it will take an awful lot of government action to override local resistance. And you mentioned California in particular, where there has been very much an anti-growth attitude because so many people moved into California for so many decades that those are there. Well, it's a drawbridge kind of mentality. You know, after me, the drawbridge, I don't want any more coming in. And I can understand that mentality. But I think it will take a concerted national effort. And I think it will happen because the voters are just mad as hell.
What is this going to mean for economic growth? And can this extend the business cycle, even though it may take 2 or 3 years to actually get put into place? Because, Gary, we're, what, year 8 in this economic recovery? Economic growth has been anemic, 2.1%. It was 1.9% in the fourth quarter of last year. We've got the Fed raising interest rates, and we know if they raise interest rates enough, if they do that, we know what happens. You usually get a recession. So it reminds me of an article I recently read in the Journal that said that this president could be the luckiest president in that he presides over the longest business expansion in history, or he'll end up facing a recession. Which of those two do you think are most likely?
Well, let's put it this way. Recessions start from really two events, at least in the post-World War II period. One is the Fed getting very, very concerned about an overheating economy and jacking up rates to the point that they kill the goose. And by our reckoning, in 12 tries in the post-war period, all they want to do is cool off the economy. They don't want to deliberately precipitate a recession. But by our reckoning, in 12 attempts, they only succeeded in effecting a soft landing once in the mid-90s. The other times they got a recession. So the odds are, when the Fed really gets the bit in its mouth and jacks up rates decisively, you'll get a recession. Now, I don't think that's going to happen. They're now scheduled to raise rates. They say they're going to have 3 rate increases this year. Now that the odds, the markets say there's a low probability of that, and they've been saying that for years. And I think one of the main reasons they say that is their credibility is so shot. They've been predicting rapid economic growth, surging inflation, near-term rate increases for the last 6 years, and they've always had to back down on it. So I think credibility is a big driving force there, plus the fact they don't like distorting effects of low interest rates. But I don't see the Fed, I don't see the economy strong enough anytime soon that the Fed is going to do that. Now, maybe if this fiscal stimulus really gets rolling, but that's 2 or 3 years down the road. Now, I don't see that in the immediate future. The other way you can get a recession, economic softness, and certainly a big sell-off in stocks is a shock. A financial shock. And that's what we had in the late 90s with the dot-com collapse, and then the mid-2000s when the subprime mortgage market blew up. In both cases, you had recessions as well as financial crises associated with them. Now, are there financial shocks out there? Yeah, I mean, particularly you mentioned my 2010 book, The Age of Deleveraging. I talk it there at length about my history of looking at bubbles and excesses. And right now, I don't see any that are just cruising for a bruising, nothing like a subprime mortgage build-up in the mid-2000s. Yeah, if China really blew up and it had international implications, more so than I suggested earlier, that could do it. If we had a big collapse in oil prices, and I don't think OPEC is going to be able to cut back production enough to avoid a further price decline, but if that's a substantial price decline, that could be a financial shock, and that could do the job. By the way, let me just go back. We were talking about this no growth attitude, and just an interesting anecdote. A long-term friend of ours, a guy named Mike Patton. Mike Patton was located in, he still is in Southern California, and he was a developer there, and he was faced with this no growth attitude. he develops shopping centers. And he tells this wonderful story on himself how, at least a decade ago, he went over to Las Vegas and had heard that there were great opportunities there. And he met with some of the town fathers and they said, "Oh, yeah, we're here to help you." And he said, "Oh, yeah, I know what that means." And he said, "I couldn't believe it. They actually were. They wanted to help me develop shopping centers there." Very unlike Southern California, because at that point, Las Vegas was not nearly as developed as Southern California. This is some years ago.
So as we take a look at the economy, which is cruising at about 2%, if these infrastructure projects finally get implemented, and let's say it takes 2 or 3 years, that could bump up economic growth by a full percentage point. So outside a financial shock, do you see this economy kind of muddling through over the next couple of years until these projects get implemented? Kind of what we've seen over the last couple of years with monetary stimulus off and on. We grow like we did in the third quarter, and then we have these fits and starts. Are we more likely to see that over the next couple of years before this kicks in?
Yeah, I think so. That, you know, this book they referred to, The Age of Deleveraging, I wrote in 2010, I forecast in there 2% real inflation-adjusted GDP growth at an annual rate until those whole excesses were worked off. And so far, it's averaged 2.1%, almost exactly that forecast. And I think that continues until something happens. It's slow growth. It's well below par. It's certainly left a lot of people who are discouraged, who are not in the labor force, people working for lower wages than they were for, not only because of globalization, but because of slow growth domestically. But I think that's the odds-on bet. And I've got to say, Jim, in our forecast year after year, and I'm not smart enough to get all the dips and doodles on a monthly or even a quarterly basis. I just say I think it's 2% until something happens out there. And so far, that's been, I think, a pretty good forecast. So I think that's probably what's going to continue. Now, again, if the fiscal stimulus really takes off and we start to see the economy get exuberant, and then the Fed gets worried about overheating and really jacks up rates, or we get a shock in the meanwhile, that could make a big difference. But I don't see anything on the immediate horizon. Economic expansions don't die of old age. They die for some reason. And I don't see that immediate reason right now, although a shock could come out of the blue anytime, of course.
Well, let's talk about something that we've seen from the election. After Trump's election, we saw bond yields skyrocket along with the stock market. You still contend, and you're one of the few that I've seen over the last couple decades. I mean, you nailed it. You've been a continuous bull when it comes to the treasury market. Do you still hold that view? And do you think interest rates have gotten ahead of the story as well?
Yeah, I do. Because, again, right after the election, the assumption was that we were going to have instant fiscal stimulus, and that would take tremendous increase issues of treasuries to advance, because it would be have a big increase in deficit, and that would be pretty clear. And therefore, you'd flood the market with treasuries, and that would push up interest rates. So investors said, "Hey, we know where we're going. Let's get there quick." Well, two differences that we've been pointing out where we differ from that. One is this idea, as we discussed, it's going to take a lot longer than tomorrow to get this fiscal stimulus action going and those deficits to increase. The second one is, what will be the reaction of the central banks? Now, the central banks have tacitly admitted that monetary policy is impotent, that it has not done a job. It has not rekindled growth. They knocked down interest rates to zero. They flooded the economies here and really throughout the G7 countries with a quantitative easing. And guess what? You still have very slow growth. It hasn't done the job. I can go into details of why, but it hasn't done the job. So the central banks, back over the last year, they've tacitly admitted that their monetary policy is impotent. And the way they've done that is to call for fiscal action. They've said, we can't do the job alone. We need help. Now, I don't think that these central bankers are going to sit there and let a huge issuance of treasuries run long-term interest rates through the roof and choke off the effects of fiscal stimuli. In other words, to negate the effects. So what they will do is basically to buy those treasuries that are issued to finance this fiscal stimuli. It's called helicopter money. That's sort of the current term for it. But it's not all that unusual. You go back to World War II, and of course, then it was a shooting war. Now it's a war on slow growth, but wars are wars. And the whole point is that you had huge treasury issues, and the Fed back then bought a lot of them. Money supply increased at a 25% annual rate because they were doing their part to soak up these treasury issues to hold down interest rates, which were really pegged, and to finance the war effort. They didn't want to raise taxes, and that would have been tough on patriotism. It's the same kind of mechanism. So I think we'll have what they're now calling helicopter money.
So when we take this to the investment markets, we've seen the stock market up over 10% since the election. Bond yields have risen. Obviously, there's two different stories there, and only one of them is going to end up sort of being right. As you look at the markets, it seems to me, Gary, at least this has been our view, that the markets are getting way ahead of all these possibilities, whether it's tax cuts, whether it's the repeal of Obamacare, or it's infrastructure spending. As you and I have been discussing here, it's going to be several years before this gets implemented. In between then, you know, sooner or later, we're going to have a reality check here where the markets are saying, wait a minute, they haven't even passed anything yet. So your view is that, number one, you think the dollar will continue to be robust, especially on the trade issues we've been talking about. Number two, you see treasury bonds rallying. Number three, you think OPEC will not be able to maintain production cuts, could be offset by, let's say, production gains in the U.S. with shale. So commodity prices could come down, which would also be less inflationary. So that could bring yields down. And you think that equity prices are uncertain. Let's talk about those in terms of what all of this means for investors.
Yeah, I think there was a definite jumping of the gun. And maybe the gun isn't even going to go off in the way that investors had hoped. You know, one of the interesting explanations of this is animal spirits. Now, that was a term coined by John Maynard Keynes to really quantify ignorance, to explain how people react to circumstances that you can't otherwise rationally explain. And I think that it's animal spirits is the term now that is really standing for a lot of hope that somehow this is going to work out without any clear-cut logical explanation. And you know, it is always possible human beings are somewhat unpredictable, but I do think that we are looking at a world where, and we're seeing this recently with Trump not being able to roll over Washington the way he thought, backing away from some of the extremes like branding China a manipulator on day one of his presidency. Well, that was, over a month ago. And I rather suspect that it will take time. But in the meanwhile, these four investment positions that you just outlined that we cover in our monthly newsletter, yeah, I think that we are going to see higher treasury bond prices, lower yields, because there's a realization that we're not going to have all that big fiscal stimulus and it'll come later. And when people began to realize, if I'm right, that the Fed will buy up the treasuries anyway, I think that's further reason to expect lower yields and higher prices. And treasuries are a safe haven. Dollar's a safe haven. Everybody in the world is trying to devalue against the dollar. We talked about that earlier. Commodity prices, you've just got too much excess supply in the world, and particularly OPEC. You know, OPEC was playing this game of chicken trying to force somebody else to cut production because they're getting tired of being a swing producer. And guess what? They're the chickens in their game of chicken. They're the ones that are being forced to cut, and their big enemy are the American frackers. And these guys are at it hot and heavy, increasing their production, not only newly drilled, but what are called drilled but uncompleted wells. So I think that commodity prices are on the way down. As far as stocks, you know, again, bull markets don't die of old age, but this one is certainly a very extended, and stocks are extremely expensive. You look at earnings on stocks on the basis of the last 12 months' earnings, where you look at this Shiller PE, which is based on 10 years of inflation-adjusted earnings. Stocks are about 40% above their norm there. And then the earnings to which the price-earnings ratio is applied are questionable. We made this point repeatedly that you haven't had the revenue growth in this expansion that is the normal way you get earnings. You get the revenue growth, you subtract costs, you got to the bottom line, profits. But with slow economic growth, unit volume has been very sluggish for most businesses. Most businesses have had more declining prices than increasing, no pricing power. So you haven't had revenue growth. So the route to profits growth has been cutting costs. And cutting costs, most costs, directly or indirectly, are for labor. And that did indeed push up profit margins tremendously. Of course, that was one of the reasons that real incomes have been weak. But the point is that that process, which started in the middle of the Great Recession, 2007, 2009, that ended a couple of years ago. Margins were on a high plateau, and they've been declining in the last year. And you just don't have that ability to cut costs further, at least for now. So I think that price-earnings ratios are very high, and the earnings to which apply them are very questionable.
So if I was, let's say, summing this up as an investor, we've seen this rise in bond yields, which is, if the market wakes up or individuals wake up as investors and say, wait a minute, they haven't even passed the tax cuts and they're still working on the infrastructure. Sooner or later, Gary, this needs to be reflected in what we see in earnings. And we know that when earnings fall short of expectations, we know what the market does.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jim. I think you're right. I think it's a rather precarious situation right now, and one that, to me, means a lot of caution. Portfolios we manage, we've got more cash than we've ever had as a percentage of assets.
And finally, one last question. I was glad to see you picked up on a couple themes that we've been following, and that is what is happening to brick-and-mortar retailers. We've seen Macy's, Nordstrom's. Nordstrom's is closing down one of its major stores here in San Diego because you take a look at the statistics, especially in the retail market during Christmas. I mean, online retailing is just killing bricks and mortars. But there's an implication to all of this. And that is what's happening to these big malls where, you know, we're used to seeing these big malls, Gary, where you have these big anchor tenants like a Sears, a Nordstrom's, or a Macy's. What this does to commercial real estate with this sort of retraction here in the growth of, let's say, brick and mortar retailers, the implication for commercial real estate. I read an interesting story the other day where a shopping mall in Texas was turned over, and it was turned over to a junior college.
I hadn't seen that one. That's great. What are they going to do with it?
Yeah, well, they're going to turn it into, I guess you take a shopping mall, I guess they turn it into a large junior college. But we're seeing that here, where you're seeing a lot of, and I call it my parking lot indicator, and I drive by. Yeah, you just don't see the traffic there. So let's talk just briefly here what this means for, let's say, REITs as an investment, especially commercial real estate.
Yeah, you know, and this reminds me very much of the subprime mortgage collapse earlier, because the commercial real estate has been very strong lately, and it's a lot of the reasons was because of low interest rates, and this was an attractive alternative. And one of the areas of these mortgage-backed securities issued on bonds used to finance shopping centers and so on, which could be very vulnerable, very much like subprime mortgages in the mid-2000s. And you do have a situation where online retailing is just eating the lunch of the bricks and mortar stores. And by the way, that's very deflationary. It's very efficient, of course, much more efficient. And I think more and more, one of the interesting things, Jim, the younger generation, they're people who are accustomed to using their cell phones for everything, and they don't have that habit of going to stores as older people do. So as the population rolls over, this is likely to continue as you have more and more people who are used to this kind of thing. So, and if you lose these anchor tenants and all the little stores in between them, the jewelry stores and stationery stores and so on, they obviously are in trouble. And then you worry about the real estate in the area, residential real estate that's been built around shopping malls. This thing could have a very profound effect as people basically shift away from going to bricks and mortar stores in general and do a lot more online.
Well, it's absolutely amazing. And do you think, Gary, you know, one of the things that I've seen, at least following this, is a lot of these owners of the malls that have debt on the property are just simply walking away rather than trying to negotiate with the banks and refinance it. They're saying, you know what, you can have the mall. And this was one of the stories on that mall in Texas where the owners walked away and the bank sitting here with a shopping mall, they didn't want it. All of a sudden, one of the local school districts came up and said, hey, we'll take it off your hands for a low price.
Yeah, well, that's true, Jim. And one of the things, of course, that these mall operators have been scrambling to replace these stores, they put in fitness centers, restaurants, movie theaters, anything else. But whether they can replace the lease rental is, I think, highly questionable. And again, if people don't have a reason to go to a mall anyway, yeah, if they're there, they may stay for dinner. But if they're not doing shopping there, are they as likely to go there to begin with? So I think there's a lot of rear guard action here, and you can understand how people, mall operators, are trying their best to do this. But bear in mind that leases all don't mature every month. So a lot of the pain is yet to be felt as the leases roll over. And as you point out, if a store folds, when they make the last lease payment, unless they literally default, that may be the end. It may be down the road before that last monthly check comes in.
Well, Gary, I want to thank you for sharing your time with us today. But before we close, why don't you tell our listeners about your monthly publication, Insight? It's one of my favorite. I read it every single month. And also something I would highly recommend our listeners, if they really want to understand the last 8 years, why we've had this subpar growth, why the economy's been anemic and markets been the way they are, your book, The Age of Deleveraging, which came out in 2010 and basically nailed it.
Yeah, well, it did. And that book is still available from Amazon or in bookstores, The Age of Deleveraging, Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation. That's the subtitle. Our newsletter, it's a monthly newsletter, and it tends to run 40, 50 pages every month. We usually have two or three articles of interest on the economy. You and I have talked about the contents of the last few of them, and I appreciate your careful preparation on that, Jim. But it is available, and if anyone's interested, they can visit our website. It's www.agaryshilling.com, and it's agaryshilling.com. Or they can call our toll-free number, and people want a sample copy, be happy to send them one. The number is 888-346-7444. 888-346-7444.
And once again, let me just put in a great plug for your book, The Age of Deleveraging. It is one of my favorite of your books because, I mean, you really explained what we've seen, what has been so difficult for the Fed to predict. They should have read your book, Gary.
I appreciate you saying so.
Yeah, you write another one. Please send it to the Fed chairman. I think Bernanke and Yellen should have read it, and maybe they would have understood and not had to back off from so many of their forecasts the last 6 years. Well, Gary, listen, my friend, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for coming on the program, and have yourself a great weekend.
Well, you too.
You know, it was interesting to hear Gary Shilling say a lot of what we have discussed here for the last couple of weeks on the show. There's a lot of optimism about the Trump administration's promises about what it's going to do. But if you look at some of the uphill battles it's going to be implementing these, look at tax reform alone. Now, you know that's going to be a battle, trying to seriously revamp the IRS code and streamline and smooth things out and get it off the backs of small businesses and things of that nature, or any of the other projects which he's doing. Look at the problems you have right now. What is it in California trying to build a freeway? It's been tangled up in environmental stuff for over 10 years. That's why you can't get anything done.
Oh, we had just one freeway connecting Interstate 15 with 5, John. That was over a decade. And we have two cities, Pasadena and Alhambra, that have been arguing over 6 miles a stretch of building freeway. That's been going on for 60 years. So as Gary and I were talking about there, the president can propose, Congress can dispose, but once again, it's going to be carried out at the local level. And every president from George W. Bush found out in his administration when he tried to pass stimulus, and President Obama found out in his administration, where I think after 2 or 3 years after the money was actually approved, only 30% of the money had got spent. So this is, in my opinion, and I've maintained this, just looking at the markets have gotten way ahead of themselves in terms of the impact, in terms of economic growth. But one thing Gary did say, he goes, when it does get implemented, this could add 1% to economic growth. And I think what is more important, outside a economic shock, he believes that this economy can muddle through. And I think a lot of that, it once again, is going to depend on my own contention, what the Fed does. Because at least on Capitol Hill this week, that was a story that nobody is really paying much attention to. But she sounded, okay, we're still going to do it, but a bit of a caution on the Fed side, which I imagine, John, they're going to have to do. I mean, what do you do when the economic numbers drop down to 1.9% in the fourth quarter? The Fed has got to be saying, wait a minute, we've been predicting this strong growth, and all of a sudden economic growth slipped from over 3% back down to below 2%. And for 2016, it's going to come in below 2%. So, there are a lot of variables out there, but the one I think that Gary and I both agree on, this market has gotten ahead of itself.
Well, that remains to be seen. I mean, not remains to be seen, but we're going to see it play out. And I'm wondering what the downshot of it's going to be once it realizes that. And so, having said all of that, for this week's Financial Sense News Hour, it's not a dull time to be in financial news work. Anything coming up in the near future to which we are looking forward?
You know, I think 2017 is going to be a first half and a second half story. I think the good part of 2017 is going to be in the first half. And I think when the realization that all of this stuff is not going to get done immediately or implemented immediately, I think you're going to have a different story in the second half of the year. So I think the best part is going to be in the first half of the year, because this is a year, John, where a lot of things are going to be determined. What happens in the market politically, as we talked with my guest in the first hour today. So a lot of stuff is going to be driven by politics this year, which means the news cycle is going to be, well, we're going to have no shortage of things to talk about. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.